Welcome to Talk of the Bay. I'm speaking with Farah Sabah. He is the Superintendent of Education for Santa Cruz County. Welcome to Talk of the Bay. Thanks for being here.
Rachel, thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Well, it's been an eventful couple of weeks. I wanted to talk to you about the impact of cuts, potential cuts, and potential changes to the Department of Education at the federal level and how that might move its way to our local situation. So, maybe just an open-ended question. How are things looking from your desk?
Well, we've been monitoring the activities of the new administration and really looking at some of the policy changes, also the executive orders and action taken, and also the threats to cuts to funding. And so we're very concerned about the potential impacts for our educational community here in Santa Cruz County. As these policy changes are reducing protections for or attempting to reduce protections for some of our more vulnerable communities, also allowing immigration enforcement to take place on school campuses, and other steps that they've taken that I think could have some very, very detrimental effects for our schools.
Let's start out by educating the listeners who may or may not know what the National Federal Education Department actually funds and does. You want to give us a little primer? I was surprised to see how far-reaching it is, and most people might not know how it might affect them personally.
Right. So the federal government, most of the funding that comes into schools is funded by the state and not by the federal government. In California, we receive about 9% of our funding from the federal government. However, that funding, much of it was enacted during the civil rights movement and was put in place to support some of the most vulnerable communities in our school system. So when I think about Title I grants, which have been put in place to serve students who come from low-income families, also students who are incarcerated and are justice involved, there are also programs that provide additional funding for us for students under the Individuals with Disabilities Act and the students who qualify for special education. We get some funding from the federal government for that. The National School Lunch Program, Head Start and Early Head Start, and a variety of different supports also for after-school programs, also supports for students to pursue higher education. And so most of these programs are designed to help students who come from underrepresented, marginalized communities to be successful in our educational system and beyond. So any cuts, any disruptions to those funding sources will have an outsized impact in our school districts that serve those communities. And so we're very concerned about what that could look like for our students here in Santa Cruz County.
From what I understand, it's not actually legal to, by executive order, eliminate the Department of Education. They did open the door to lots of firings, it sounds like. So, what are people saying the various scenarios could be?
When we look at the concerns and the threats to education, we try to separate the rhetoric from the actual steps that are taking place. And yes, the rhetoric has been that the administration is wanting to get rid of the Department of Education, that they are going to be cutting programs that don't align to their priorities. And we recognize that in many cases, steps that are taken that don't follow the proper process are going to be held up through litigation and in the courts because they would be violating a lot of the protections against using a political measure to determine which educational programs or services could continue to be in place. But we are seeing steps. For example, one of the steps that the administration has taken is to remove gender identity as one of the categories to protect people from discrimination. Meaning, at the federal level, That person who is being discriminated against because of their gender identity would not have, for example, Title IX protections from the federal government. However, here in California, we have very strong protections for our LGBTQ community, our trans community, and that really protect folks in ways that wouldn't allow for that kind of discrimination to take place. Some other steps that are taken. We recently heard that the administration has cut $900 million in contracts for federal contracts for a variety of different programs, including the Institute of Educational Sciences and other research institutions that really were responsible for providing information to the school community. We understand that for them to eliminate the Department of Education, it would take legislative action by both houses. And so that would be something that has not occurred yet, although there are bills that include attempts to eliminate the Department of Education. And this, I think, would also impact many of the programs that they offer support with, as the ones that I mentioned, and other ones like the Migrant Education Program, Migrant Head Start, and a variety of other federal programs that would be impacted because they would no longer have that oversight from the Department of Education at the federal level.
As someone who teaches at UC Santa Cruz, my students ask me about this, and it's, not K-12, but it affects Pell Grants, it sounds like, and those would have to be moved completely to a new department or put toward private lenders, and this would throw into disarray quite a lot of people's lives if they knew they had to pay 200 a month more, which is what they're saying, for their student loans. And this is very different than the conversation a year ago where Biden was trying to forgive student loans and the Supreme Court stopped him from doing that. So that's a whole other tangle that would have to be untangled.
I agree. I think that it's also important to as you're mentioning, Rachel, to think about the individual impacts, folks who are getting some kind of resource, some funding directly from the federal government, as well as the institutions that get funding. Now, in the K-12 system, I mentioned that only 9% of our funding comes from the federal government. When you go to higher education, the numbers are much bigger. Cabrillo College's budget, about 25% of their funding sources are federal. And you look at university campuses, they rely on a variety of federal programs to be able to implement a lot of the programming services and research that they do. And so these cuts could have a big impact, the whole spectrum of, from cradle to career for our community.
And there's the outside of the legal process that's happening with Elon Musk entering into these departments and cutting willy-nilly, but in an opaque way where we don't know as the public what's being slashed and how it's being slashed and whether it's permanently broken as far as the infrastructure and cybersecurity. We had an unprecedented moment where five Treasury secretaries, former secretaries, wrote a letter that was published in the New York Times saying this could constitute a constitutional crisis if they ignore the courts. I mean, the courts seem to be doing the right thing, but they're often temporary stays. So I wonder what happens if they ignore the court orders and keep on messing with these departments and making it really hard to get that money because they did something to the procurement process or. I don't know if that's a discussion happening at the local level, the what ifs, but it does feel like that's a high possibility since it's already happened up over in Treasury Department.
Well, I think, when I teach a class, I co-teach a class over the summer for our student trustees. And one of the first things we talk about is how all power that is given in a democracy has to be linked directly to voters. And that if there is a person who works in an institution for the government, that they have to answer to somebody who may have to answer to somebody who is voted in. And the chief of police is under the city council. The city council is elected by the people, And so one of the fundamental aspects of democracy, and what I believe is what education is about, is to help students be active participants in that democracy, is to ensure that there is proper oversight and there are checks and balances in place. And so as an educator who works with young people and wants them to be active participants in that democracy, any disruption to those checks and balances, to that proper oversight and the link back to voters is of concern. And you mentioned the word opaque, not understanding what the implications are of folks who are entering and making changes to how funding is distributed and whatnot. Is of course of great concern, and not only for the educational system, but just for our society and our country as a whole.
Absolutely. And you really hit the nail on the head. And I've been talking to my college students about this. What are the checks and balances? And we had a Congress with a very thin margin, no giant mandate, but the Republicans are in charge of all three branches of government right now. And they the Senate just approved the heads of these agencies. And a lot of the heads of the agencies that they approved are people who have been huge critics of those same agencies and are now tasked with taking them apart, some of which they don't have the power to take apart, some of which they can severely impact through firings. So I wonder, if Congress is supposed to have the power of the purse, and yet you have an unelected guy in there slashing programs willy-nilly based on some very vague criteria of waste, fraud, and abuse, which he personally will decide what is wasteful or politically inconvenient. And on top of that, you have him with contracts before the federal government and the very agencies he's now allowed access to. Today, they announced that the federal government would be purchasing something like $400 million worth of Tesla product, which just feels like tin pot dictatorship territory to me, where corruption, they're removing the barriers to corruption, then they're exacting corruption on us as taxpayers. And these are the richest people in the world. They're already richer. And then our students, I had a student yesterday who did not have a coat and it was raining. And we asked him, "Where's your sweater?" He said, "I don't own one." He had run away from home to come to college. So I'm sure you have stories like that of individuals in our education system that really need these programs to function properly for their everyday survival.
I think part of our role, and my role personally, all the superintendents I work with and other leaders in the educational community, we feel like part of our goal is to shield our community from the impacts, but also the rhetoric. One of the biggest impacts of a lot of the what's happening in the media, what is being said, what is being put out into our kind of our world, is instilling a great deal of fear for our community. And so, part of what we're trying to do is reassure our community and also to provide clarity and communication as to what are the things that may impact you. For example, knowing that immigration officers have been given the green light by the current administration to conduct enforcement activity on our school campuses, even though we haven't seen that occur at any schools in the country at this point, we developed a protocol to prepare for that situation, and all the districts provided training for their staff. With systems and that are grounded in the law, and to ensure that we can minimize any kind of access for immigration officials, and except with a few very rare circumstances where they have a judicial order or whatnot. And so those systems and that kind of shielding that we want to make sure that our schools continue to be resources and hubs where people feel safe and a sense of belonging. And so part of that is ensuring that the rhetoric, the impact on our community of feeling fear that they can't go to school, that they can't go to the health clinics, that they can't go out into the community, that we can provide them as much information, as much support, and also offering them as much training about their rights through experts and through our partnerships, ensuring that we have online resources, such as a website that we developed with some community partners called susderechos.info, and ensuring that we are thinking about all the different ways, the possibilities of kind of anticipating things like cuts, policies that could come down from the federal government, and to do everything that we can to continue for our schools to continue to be safe spaces for our students and our communities, and offering all the resources that they offered for our community here in Santa Cruz County.
Ferris, have you seen a drop in attendance from families that might have immigrants in their midst?
We have seen some drops in attendance at certain moments, but overall, we haven't seen a cumulative ongoing drop in attendance over the last few weeks. But we have seen some disruptions to attendance that we think are related to some of the announcements and the rhetoric and the fear that is being instilled in our community. An educational system, we don't track immigration status. It's not something that we, and so it's not something that we, you know, look at or utilize in any aspects of what we do. But we recognize that there's many families that come from a mixed status who are deeply impacted and fearful. And we're wanting to continue to support them and our students, of course.
If a student finds out that their parent was deported and they don't have anybody to go to, what's this protocol supposed to happen with the student who's left at school, for example?
So the protocol would normally be that, we encourage families to create an emergency plan for childcare plan. Where they would identify a family member, a relative, somebody that would be able to care for their child if they're detained or deported. If that doesn't occur, we would work. We have a protocol where we would work with the family's emergency numbers that we have in our student information systems to be able to reach out to family members to identify a family member who could help. If we're not able to identify, then we would reach out to the county and their support, their family support, family and child support program to help identify possibly a court assigned family that could provide shelter and support for the child. A home for the child. This idea of preparing, anticipating, and preparing is an important aspect of the way that we're supporting families to help them think about the possibilities and identify a family member that could care for their children if they are detained.
A week or so ago, I spoke on the air with Sherry Cassidy, who is part of, I think I got her name right. Was part of a program to help parents fill out those forms and, you know, assist them so that everybody has that plan in place. And it's not, she said that they're just getting inundated with offers to help, which is really a testimony to the moment we're in, where people are stepping up and want to do whatever they can to support. One, and this is probably a rumor, but it was some parent who talked to me and said that bullying is up among children who are now like threatening each other about their status, their immigration status. I don't know if there's a discussion or policy about how to nip that in the bud and have a conversation about why, you know, that isn't okay. And we need to all support each other regardless of status.
Yeah, working on a culture of respect is I think a fundamental part of the work that we do. We did see in 2016 an increase in bullying in relation to immigration status. I think we're always this is something that we're always working on, especially in the online environment, where students, you know, hopefully they share with us that they're experiencing bullying, and the schools really work hard on creating a respectful and restorative approach so that the folks who are doing the bullying could understand the impact that they're having, and also to ensure that we're being responsive to stop bullying and to create a culture of respect in our schools. And so I think it's something that is one of the aspects of schooling that we're always working on, and we can always do better, and it is an important part of the role of the, you know, our leadership teams who are wanting, who are working hard to create those safer spaces for students. And I think that that's true in, for a lot of our vulnerable communities. We're always wanting to ensure that they feel that sense of belonging, support, and respect, and that they could bring their whole selves to school.
That's fantastic. That's in place and actively happening, regardless of who's in office where. We have just a few more minutes. I'm speaking with Farah Saba. He is the superintendent of education for Santa Cruz County. We're talking about impacts of the federal Department of Education being attacked from the executive branch and what that might mean for local schools. Any final thoughts on other approaches the school system's taking? What would happen if they experienced this 9% cut? You know, is there any talk in the state level of backfilling that and just thinking about what's ahead?
Yes, the governor has made assertions, or you know, has taken a strong position that they want to protect our communities and California from action by the Trump administration. I would you know I think I have to mention that the community, as you mentioned, Rachel, has really come together in a way. To support our most vulnerable communities. And I think that this, as difficult as this has been, it has been an opportunity for so many organizations working with agencies and leaders in the community to be able to come together and recognize that we have to stand together on behalf of our community and for the values that we believe in. And I think that this is something that it, you know, needs to continue. When I think about the people who are part of the YAR, which is the Rapid Response Team, the volunteers who are you know, we worked with Community Bridges, Community Action Board, Watsonville Life Center, just so many different agencies coming together in support of our community. And I think that this is something that inspires all of us to continue this work and is really just epitomizes, I think, this wonderful community that we have here in Santa Cruz County. I did want to share also, Rachel, that tonight we have a celebration that for our school community. It is an annual celebration where we talk about the challenges we face, the and really celebrate many of the achievements of the County Office of Education and also our partner agencies and school districts. And we also have student performances and wonderful speakers. And so we'd love to encourage all listeners to join us this evening. This is February 13th at 6 p.m. at the Live Oak Community Center. If you could join us, we would love to have folks be a part of this event and learn a little bit more about what schools are doing and also be a part of celebrating this resilient and wonderful community that we serve.
Well, I really appreciate that. And, you know, K-Squid has stepped up and started a new show called Pride Perspectives, kind of as an inspiration from what the local people are doing to look back 50 years and celebrate, you know, the Pride movement. And a lot of the students, you know, young voices are interviewing older voices. So that's been a really cool collaboration. And we always appreciate the support of us having a space in your building at the County Office of Education. Thank you for allowing us to be there and giving us a safe space to operate.
Thank you, Rachel. Thank you for listening and sharing and bringing this kind of clarity as to the what is happening and how our communities can be impacted and the steps that we can take to continue to support each other.
We'll keep in touch, okay? Thank you so
Thank
much,
you.
Farah Saba, here on K-Squid.
Thanks so much.